Tonight on this recorded edition of Extension 720, another visit with a very welcome guest, America's best-known historian these days, I should think, and deservedly so, Stephen Ambrose, whose last book was about the men who waged World War II, his previous book about the Lewis and Clark expedition, the great three-volume biography of President Nixon, and now in hand, a new book titled Nothing Like It in the World. Nothing like what?
Nothing like the Transcontinental Railroad, which spanned the continent and would made an assault on space and on time that transformed America and made modern America possible.
I was quite fascinated to find, reading this very well-crafted book, it has the sort of pace and narrative excitement that all of your writing has. I was quite surprised to find, really, that in a way it's almost a continuation of, but a transformation of, the Civil War.
Yes. The Civil War was to hold the Union together, North and South. The building of this railroad, which began in 1862 with the Pacific Railway Act, was to bind the nation together, East and West. There had been some talk in California, which is isolated from the rest of the United States by the Sierra Nevada, or so everybody thought, as well as Oregon and Washington, we're going to secede too. And we're going to have a West Coast Republic. And there were some hot-blooded Southerners in California who thought we're going to secede and join the Confederacy. And obviously the Union badly needed the gold that was coming out of California and the silver and everything else that California does better than anybody. And so Abraham Lincoln, who had been a railroad lawyer before he went into full-time politics and was just superb for the Rock Island Line and getting the bridge over the Mississippi River, insisted we have got to build a railroad out to California to hold California in the Union. And they passed the Pacific Railway Act and then amended it 2 years later in 1864, with Lincoln always being very much involved. That comes to a surprise to quite a few people who think during the Civil War, Lincoln did nothing but fight the Civil War.
It comes as quite a surprise that the Congress had anything on his mind other than the war.
And what's even a bigger surprise is the Congress did well.
Yeah.
Now, we never hear that about Congress today, and there are reasons why we don't.
Well, so they set up a pattern of incentives and structure.
They made it a race. They created two corporations, the Central Pacific coming out of Sacramento, headed east, and the Union Pacific coming out of Omaha, headed west. And they told them, race. And whoever builds the most track gets the most money. They were getting government bonds according to the laying of the track, how far out they had gotten it, and they were getting alternate sections of land for every mile of railroad completed. And so it was a race. Whoever builds the most gets the most.
And they set a deadline. They say that you've got to complete it by July 1st, 1876.
Yes, that's right. They gave them a 15-year deadline.
Yeah.
But
and
in fact, the railroads did it by May of 1869.
Yeah.
They did it. They didn't even start laying track for the Union Pacific out of Omaha until January of 1866. They had started earlier on the Central Pacific, but the Central Pacific had to get through the Sierra Nevada, and that was a lot of tunneling and terribly time-consuming and awfully difficult work, where the Union Pacific was building across Nebraska, which is ideal for laying track.
Very flat.
The Platte River is right there, so you can get your water. Once you got out into the desert in Wyoming, Utah, Nevada, there wasn't any water. There were no trees. Everything had to be hauled in.
There's another way in which there's a sort of perseveration of the Civil War. It turns out that though the major labor force is Irish going west and Chinese going east, there are also a lot of Civil War soldiers in uniform, including Confederates.
Many of them. And it was a moment of reconciliation. That is, Union and Confederate veterans working side by side, swinging those sledgehammers, driving in those spikes, laying those rails, making that grade, doing all the things that a trained track requires, working together. And they learned. You're not going to work together if you're not a team, and you've got to get along with one another. And then that reconciliation spread, so that when the Golden Spike was driven at Promontory Summit in Utah and the Transcontinental Railroad was completed, there was celebration. Chicago had the biggest parade it had ever had for the whole of the 19th century, 7 miles long. San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Springfield, St. Louis, and New Orleans, and Richmond, and Atlanta, and the other southern cities. They all celebrated this joining of the Republic together from coast to coast. And in the most extraordinary way, they say more cannon were fired that day, May 10, 1869, than were fired during the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what they said.
Some of the men who were at Gettysburg, some of the generals even, are in the field helping
to
build the
railroad. Many. The chief engineer and the head man for the Union Pacific was Grenville Dodge, who was an outstanding soldier during the Civil War. Supporting him was the now commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army, William Tecumseh Sherman, who had been on the first board of the first railroad ever in California back in 1854 when Sherman had still been in the Army. And also extraordinarily important in making this road happen was Ulysses Grant, who acted as if he were already president after he got the nomination, and then, of course, did become president. And so Grant, Sherman, Lincoln, Grenville Dodge, the Casement brothers, many others, and all these veterans that worked for the Union Pacific who came from all over the world, African-Americans, Russian-Americans, Swedish-Americans, other Scandinavians, and a lot of Irish, they were all veterans. And they were being attacked by Indians who didn't want that road running through their, what they regarded as their land. And nobody had ever asked them, and nobody had ever made any promises to pay them anything. And they didn't like the track because it divided the buffalo herd. For reasons that I don't understand, buffalo will not cross railroad tracks. Cows will, which is why you had a cow catcher on the front of the engines. But the buffalo never did. The Indians knew it was going to divide the buffalo herd and bring settlement and bring the army and bring an end to their way of life. So they attacked the railroad at many opportunities in Nebraska and Wyoming especially.
Really serious assaults?
Very serious. Numbers of people killed, overturning the trains, burning the trains, burning the end-of-track villages that had been set up. But the men who worked on the railroad carried rifles. And they'd stack them, and like that, Grenville Dodge, or whoever the chief of construction was, would see Indians on the ridgeline getting ready to come down, and they'd call these men to arms, and the men would throw down their picks or their shovels, whatever, and pick up those rifles and form a skirmish line, and the Indians very quickly learned, don't attack the Union Pacific.
In the annals of American folk music, there are a lot of railroad songs. I've been working on the railroad all the livelong day, etc. Are many of them from the making of the Transcontinental Railroad?
A number of the Irish ones are. Poor Paddy, he works on the railroad, was one, and there were many others. And the Chinese had their own songs, none of which, to my knowledge, ever became a part of a popular culture. But with the Chinese, they did.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the workforce, the Chinese heading east and the Irish heading west. The notion, and I learned from your book, it's a totally mistaken notion that's been held for some time, is that the Chinese were imported from China to do this work.
Yes, that's right. The myth is that they came over in what amounted to slave ships.
Yeah.
And practically, the foremen were behind them with whips to make sure they stayed at work. In fact, the great majority of Chinese, some 10,000 altogether, that worked for the Central Pacific were already in California. They're almost all males that came over from China, and they came to California for the same reason that Americans went to California, to get rich. They wanted to pick up that gold as well. They were forbidden by the California state legislature from engaging in any kind of mining activity, and so they ended up being domestics or cooks or working in the laundry or some kind of drudgery. And the Central Pacific came along and said, we'll pay you guys $3 to $4 a day if you come out and work on this.
That's big money, isn't it?
Big money. And they volunteered, and they came out, and they, like the men working for the Union Pacific, were all volunteers. They wanted to be there. And they were collecting big money for laboring men at that time and getting fed pretty well, especially the Chinese, who insisted on a Chinese diet, and they got it out of San Francisco. It was an American enterprise that was never to be matched. When the Russians built the Trans-Siberian Railroad, they used 100,000 Chinese and 100,000 convicts from Siberia, and they laid a train. They didn't get it done until 25 years after we had crossed the continent with the UPNC.
And they lost many more laborers.
They lost many, many more laborers, and they laid an inferior track.
Yeah.
was all government done. And the government owned that railroad. In the United States, the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific are the two biggest corporations of the 19th century.
Set up and really endorsed by the government and given all sorts of help by the government. And there are those who write with a somewhat more Marxist slant than you do, who wrote a long time ago, and some of which probably even today say, well, but this was a case of rampant, in some ways, brigand-like capitalism supported by congressmen, many of whom quite possibly were paid off for their assistance to the railroad magnates.
Yep, that's all true.
It is all true.
Well, to a certain extent. I was taught at the University of Wisconsin in the 1950s, as everybody was in their American History Survey at that time, that these guys were robber barons, that they just stole the country blind. Mm-hmm. And we gave them all of that land, every alternate section, all the way out to California, and gave them government bonds, depending on if it were prairie or if it was foothills or it was mountains, as much as $64 million per mile, or just $64,000 per mile. That the railroaders got filthy rich out of this, and then they used that power to dominate, especially California, but even national politics. And the biggest scandal of the 19th century, the Credit Mobilier, was about the construction company that the UP hired to build this track, and which the UP paid enormous quantities of money to, and they had a 200% dividend. That's not bad, 200%. But they didn't do anything. It was a dummy corporation, and stock in that corporation had been given to congressmen, including a future vice president.
And which scandal, future vice president?
Schuyler right? Colfax. And the scandal uh-huh. broke, and it was the biggest thing of the 19th century and led to the Populist Party and the Progressive Party, which came about primarily because Colas Huntington and the other big four in California, as well as the directors of UP, subscribe to, Huntington said it himself, charge all the traffic will bear. And they did. And so the farmers revolted against this. And you get these two parties, the populists and the progressives. The truth is that the land grants didn't even begin to cover the cost of building those railroads. Not even close. You could sell land for $250 an acre in Nebraska, but once you got out to Wyoming, who the hell's going to buy a section of land in Wyoming? Never rains out there, and you can't graze cattle. You need, you know, thousands of acres if you're going to have a herd, and that continues all the way up to the Sierra Nevada. So they, the story that I was told, that they, we just gave all this stuff to the railroad, it didn't happen like that. And the other is that we gave them all those government bonds, but in fact those were loans from the government. They had to be paid back in 30 years at 6% interest per year, and that was done. So this was, for Uncle Sam, the best bargain of the 19th century and can be only rivaled, in my mind, by the GI Bill of 1944 in Congress doing what we're always hoping Congress is going to do, acting for the benefit of the whole people.
The president, during much of the construction of the railroad, was Lincoln's vice president, who succeeded him after the assassination, namely Andrew Johnson. Mm-hmm. Did he play any role in all of this?
Johnson kind of dug in his heels, and he was favoring the Central Pacific over the Union Pacific, and his cabinet was engaged in shenanigans that one wishes they hadn't been engaged in, and that was Johnson's role. The directors of both the UP and CP couldn't wait to get him out of office, and they eventually did, of course, and Ulysses Grant became president.
That is a majestic moment. One has a number of great pictures. One particular one, of course, which is reproduced in your book. I should say again that Stephen Ambrose's new book is titled Nothing Like It in the World. It is published by
Simon & Schuster.
Simon & Schuster, and not an unheard of publishing company. but I'm referring to the picture of that meeting at Promontory
the
Point.
The meeting of the Jupiter and the 119.
And the driving in, supposedly.
And the driving in of the spike.
Of the golden spike.
It was a moment that resounds with us today, because we are accustomed to, when an event happens, we know about it right away. If there's an earthquake in China, we're going to know about it on CNN right away. Mm-hmm. If war breaks out between Pakistan and India, we're going to know when the first shot is fired. This was the first time that had ever happened. They hooked up the telegraph wire to the sledgehammer and then to the rail where the golden spike, the last spike, was going to go in. And when it was hit, it was flashed all across the nation, indeed all across the world. People in London knew about it at exactly the same time that people in San Francisco knew about it, which is the same as the people of Chicago or St. Louis or New Orleans or New York and so on. Mm-hmm. This experience that we take for granted happened here for the first time, and it set off all those parades.
Who had the honor of driving in the spike?
Well, Leland Stanford, but he missed. But it was all right. They were able to fix that up fine, and he did hit the rail, and the telegraph operator tapped out the word done, and it was completed, and all these parades started off.
That, of course, is the same Leland Stanford who gave the money that established Stanford University.
That's right, and he got that money out of the Central Pacific Railway.
Yeah.
Sure.
We must talk more about the actual engineering feat that was accomplished in those. It was really just a space of about, what, 5 years?
Yes, that's right. That's
and
right.
We'll talk about the making of the road itself physically right after we return to Stephen Ambrose following these words. And we return to conversation with Stephen E. Ambrose. We're drawing from his very gripping new book, Nothing Like It in the World, The Men Who Built the Transcontinental Railroad, 1863 to 1869. We've talked about some of the men. We haven't named all of the important corporate figures, but we'll get around to some of them. But right now, let me turn to one of them who's also an engineer and also a great enthusiast, namely this fellow Judah.
Ted Judah. Very young man, grew up in New England, had been involved in building railroads, had gone to Rensselaer Polytechnic and gotten an engineering degree, and had been involved in the building of railroads and got an opportunity to go to California to work on the first railroad out there, the Sacramento Valley Railroad, and immediately started exploring the Sierra Nevada to look for a pass, to look for a way to get up there, to look for a way to get over it. And he found the pass, and it was not new. That is, it was the Bonner Party had tried to, the Donner Party had tried.
Was that Donner Lake?
Yeah, just above Donner Lake, yeah. But that he found a ridgeline going up with the American River off to the south, going up to nearly the summit. Then he had to drill 16 holes through that granite. Not holes, tunnels, through the granite in order to get through. The locomotives of the time, the locomotives of today, can't go up that steep an incline, but they can go through tunnels.
How do you make a tunnel through granite mountains in the 1860s? You don't do it the way you would do it today.
No, it was all done by hand, and gunpowder. The Chinese worked on both sides of these tunnels, and they would work in teams of threes. One guy would hold up the drill, a steel drill, and the other two would bring up 14 to 18 pound sledgehammers and whomp, hit the end of that drill, and then whomp. And that would go on for half an hour, three quarters, an hour, and they would get a hole deep enough you could pack in some black powder, and then put a fuse in, and then light that fuse, and then run like hell. And get out of there, boom, up it goes, and shatters some granite. You go back in with a hand cart and take out the granite that you have dislodged and do the same thing all over again. Now, they did that 24 hours a day. They all lived in the tunnels. It didn't matter if it was day or night. They never saw the sky anyway. And it took them, they made 6 inches a day. And the biggest tunnel at the very top, the Summit Tunnel, nearly a quarter of a mile long, it took them a whole year to drive that tunnel through granite. Now, the engineers of the day, Van Nostrand's Engineering Magazine, the most prestigious of all, they said, it's preposterous to think you can make a tunnel through granite. But Ted Judah said, we can do it. And by God, they did it.
And apart from his engineering skills or his visionary skills, he also was a very effective lobbyist back in Washington on and off.
He's the man who made the Transcontinental Railroad possible, because he and his wife, Anna, would go to Washington. I mean, just terrible journey. You know, you start at San Francisco, you go down to Panama, and then you got to get over the isthmus.
You don't go there by railroad.
Yeah, that's right. You don't go by railroad. And he would go to Washington, and his wife was a wonderful artist, and she'd go out on these trips with him when he was exploring, and she would paint the scenery. And then she set up a room in the Capitol showing congressman who would come to visit, here's where we're going to go and here's what we're going to do. And Judah, meanwhile, worked very hard on the capitalists on the East Coast, and even more so on the congressman. And after Lincoln became president, on Abraham Lincoln, and he got an agreement. All right, we're going to do it. We're going to try for it. It didn't cost the United States anything. They were loaning the bonds, and they were giving away land that was useless without a railroad. What the hell good is a piece of land in the middle of Nebraska if there isn't any railroad? You can't get your crops to market. What good is it having a gold mine on the other side of the Sierra Nevadas if you can't get over the Sierra Nevadas?
You tell us that at the time they began, and they began on the eastern end from Omaha, that there was essentially no white settlement west of Omaha.
Except for Salt Lake City.
Except for Salt Lake City.
Which the Mormons, of course, had left Council Bluffs and had gone out to Salt Lake.
Yeah.
But between Omaha and Sacramento, no white settlements. Not on the line that they built, because Salt Lake City was about 40 miles south of the line. Yeah, nobody. Everybody lived out there was an Indian. And illiterate and opposed to progress and had no interest in what the Americans were interested in, which was a connection with California.
Basically, to build a railroad, you lay track. You may have to cut through months to find a place to put the track, but you're laying track day after day after day.
That's right.
And they apparently developed some tremendous efficiency in the laying of track itself.
They can do it faster than we can do it today.
Really?
They could do it almost at the pace of a walking man. The record came from the Central Pacific in the last part of April in 1869, when they did 10 miles in one day, a feat never before done and never since equaled. And it was all done with muscle power, with little handheld carts and with men picking up the rails and placing the rails on the ties that had already been placed on by hand. And then the men spiking in those rails, and then the guys coming along to fill in the ballast. That's all done by hand. And it was from morning till night. You got up, if you were working for the Union Pacific, you got up at first light and you made your toilet and maybe had a coffee and you went to work. And just about noon, the foreman would call, "Time!" And you would go and have your meal, which was primarily boiled beef and baked potatoes and coffee. And the men made a business out of that eating. I mean, these guys were working awfully hard and they were eating prodigious quantities. And after an hour, back to work, with the foreman cursing at them to get them awake from the noontime lassitude. And then they worked until dusk. Now, this is in Nebraska, where the days can last in the summer a very long time. And then at dusk, time! And then they would have their evening meal, and then they would collapse into their sleeping compartments, which were sometimes up on top of the cars, the construction cars. And then the next morning, they're up at first light.
What was available to them? What was available to them by way of, you say, after the meal they went to sleep? Did they always? What was available to them by way of entertainment, amusement?
Well, it depended on where they were. But if they were at or near a Hell on Wheels, which was the name of the, they call them towns. It was really tent cities. It was mainly Chicago people, Chicago sharks, who brought out liquor and brought out dance hall apparatus and brought out prostitutes and brought out a lot of gamblers. And they would set up this Hell on Wheels town at the end of track, when the track paused for the winter. And there were North Platte in Nebraska, and then Julesburg in Colorado, and then Cheyenne in Wyoming, and Rollins in Wyoming, and so on. We're all end of track. Now, end of track, that's what excites Hollywood. That's what Cecil B. DeMille wanted and made the central part of his movie, The Union Pacific. It was very gaudy, a lot of light, a lot of glass, goblets and mirrors, a lot of paintings, all of it covered by tent, and all kind of women for either dancing or for going upstairs with, all kind of whiskey, usually watered down, and you had a clientele that was 18 and 19 and 20 years old, many of them Irish, who had just been paid, and they had nothing else to spend their money on. And they're away from any constraints of home or hearth, and so they had a good time. The Chinese, not at all. The Chinese worked 6 days a week. They got Sundays off. they ate a whole lot better than the UP workers did, because they were bringing in all this Chinese menu from San Francisco. And their one relaxation came on Sundays when they would take a little bit of opium. And it would help them relax. It didn't make them silly, and they didn't do stupid things, but they would take that opium and then relax all day long to rest up for the 6 days of hard labor they were going to put in. The Chinese never drank. The Irish all the time, of course.
What were the attrition rate on these workforces?
We don't know. They did not keep a record. How many Chinese lost their thumbs? How many had their hands just smashed by a sledgehammer? Mm-hmm. How many were buried by avalanches? The Sierra Nevada gets more snow on it than any place else in America, save only Alaska. And the avalanches were a big, big problem for the Central Pacific. And I can't tell you how many because they didn't keep a record, but a lot of Chinese died in those avalanches, or they died as a result of accidents. And on the Union Pacific, a lot of men died from Indian attacks. Many died because of accidents. Engines would run into each other. Trains would derail. The engineer was killed. The fireman was killed. I mean, these people put up with a lot more in the way of accidents than we would ever do today. The total number of men who were badly injured, that is, lost a limb or killed on the two railroads, I don't know. My own guess would be between 5,000 and 8,000 men.
Yeah. Great achievements sometimes come with great costs.
Yes, that's right.
But also great fortunes were made.
Oh, boy.
Not
sure
by
were.
The workers, though.
No, not by the workers. But most of the workers stayed with railroads. They loved the work. They loved being out of doors. They loved being involved in something where you can see progress happening. The rail is moving on to the west, and we're connecting the rails and so on. So the Irishmen went to work, and the Chinese went to work on the Great Northern, or the Northern Pacific, or the Southern Pacific, or the other railways that came along after the first Transcontinental.
What is the state of the original Transcontinental Railroad right now? Is it all still in operation?
Sure, very much so. It's now double track, and sometimes triple track, and sometimes it will, for example, at Dale Creek, which was an enormous bridge made in Chicago. This was piecework. That is, in Chicago, the Boomer Company would make, according to what the engineers out on the line wanted, they'd make the trusses and all the rest of it and ship it up on railway cars. And that would get up there to Wyoming, to Dale Creek, and they'd put it all together. And these bridges reached up damn near a half mile into the sky. And the sign as you come into the bridge was locomotives slow to 2 miles an hour to go over this bridge. And it was scary to... Now, that has been, they've now gone around that.
Uh-huh.
They've eliminated that one. But overall, you ride the train today from Omaha to Sacramento, 98% of the time you're going to be on the original grade, as laid down by the surveyors. Now, the surveyors who came first were simply amazing in how well they did. They didn't have any helicopters. They didn't even have balloons. There's certainly no airplanes, nobody living out there, no maps. But they surveyed a route that has stood up to this extent. In the 1950s, when they surveyed for Interstate 80, that also runs from Omaha to Sacramento, they had airplanes, they had helicopters, they had maps, they had the example of the CP in front. They laid almost exactly the same route. Almost all the time when you're driving from Omaha to Sacramento, or the reverse, you're going to be in sight of the Union Pacific track.
I've done that, and I've seen that.
Yeah.
You have somebody saying in the book that if it hadn't been built and was built today, still the solution to how to get over the Sierra Nevada would be the very same solution that Judah settled
upon. That's right. It would have been the same.
The Donner Pass.
He picked the best route to go over.
In the little time we have left, your book deals as well, but we haven't yet in this conversation, with the transformative effects of the completion of the railroad. What did the railroad do to shape the America that we know?
It made modern America. You could go from New York to San Francisco in 7 days. Before the railroad, it took anywhere from 3 to 6 months and sometimes longer to get from New York to California. Now, 7 days. So fast, they said, you don't even have time to take a bath. And the telegraph, which laid right alongside the track, as required in the Pacific Railway Act, The telegraph meant instant communication between New York and San Francisco, or San Francisco and London, come to that. Instant. I mean, we think, we live in the age of Bill Gates and Microsoft and so on, and we think, oh, boy, I'm telling you, it happened in 1865, 1869. The coming of that telegraph made instant communication possible. That's why there is a national stock market. There wouldn't be one without the telegraph. You could move not just people, but you could move minerals, or you could move all the agricultural products of California, the fruit and the vegetables, so that in Chicago you can get fresh vegetables in January. That's one of the things that the Pacific Railway did. In other words, the Congress required that all the rails had to be made in the United States, which the Big Four complained about because they could have gotten them cheaper out of Britain. But, oh boy, what a boost that was for Pennsylvania industry, where Thaddeus Stevens, Speaker of the House, who had played a big role in the passage of this bill, had a foundry. So he got rich out of it, and that's American politics. That's the way we do things.
When Louis Napoleon comes to power in France, I think it's Louis Napoleon, he calls in all the leading businessmen of Paris, and he says, with regard to my administration, my one word to you is enrichissez-vous. Go out and enrich yourselves. He probably expected some kickback, but also he probably understood that that's the way you reinvigorate and expand the national life.
The men who invested in this railroad did so when others would not. The men who had money in this country were, I'm not going to invest in a railroad that's building out into the middle of a desert. There's no market out there. They're not producing anything out there that we can bring back. I'm not going to get involved. Also, the Civil War was on, and if you had money to loan, you got 6% a month on your loan. The railroads were offering bonds, paying 4 or 5% for a year, and they could not get anybody to invest. So that it was done by hook or by crook, by borrowing, by going deeply into debt, by a lot of subterfuge, by a lot of issuing of false stock, and all the other things that we associate with the practices of big business and corporations when they're dealing with the federal government, even today.
Your writing career as an historian starts with, I don't know whether it starts with the book on Eisenhower and then goes on to the three-volume Nixon work, but you're focused on modern political history and major political actors. But in the Lewis and Clark book already, where the focus is not only on Lewis and Clark and Thomas Jefferson, but upon the guys in the group.
Yes.
And then certainly in the book about the men who waged World War II. And now in this one, you become, in a way, a people's historian. One almost remembers the line of Carl Sandburg, the people, yes, the people. Yeah. You seem to be saying that's really where history is to be found.
That's what I have learned. I've been doing this all my life. But more and more I have found I am less interested in Dwight Eisenhower or Dick Nixon or even Thomas Jefferson as I am in the men that they inspired or that they led or that they worked with are far more fascinating to me. It's great fun and very learning experience to spend as much time. I spent a lot of my life with Dwight Eisenhower and finding out how he decided things and how. But Eisenhower never fired a rifle at a German. Nobody ever shot at Eisenhower. He never heard the whistle of a bullet going by his ear. And I find it's far more interesting to get down with the captains and the lieutenants and the sergeants and the privates who were out there in the foxholes and find out from them what they did and what happened to them. In the same way with this book on the railroad, I find that the men making the railroad, from the surveyors and the engineers and the construction bosses, but most of all the men themselves, are far more fascinating to me than their bosses were.
And it has generated a utterly fascinating book, and I'm happy to recommend it to all of our listeners, Stephen Ambrose's new volume, from which we've been drawing, but to which we cannot do full justice in a mere half hour, is titled Nothing Like It in the World, The Men Who Built the Transcontinental Railroad, 1863-1869. Simon & Schuster, the publishers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.